With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome in to this special episode of the Curzon Podcast. We're recording right from Berlin, as last night the 30th European Film Awards took place in the city, and we were lucky enough to attend. I'm Sam Heller, and today I'm joined by Jake. Hello.
Hello.
So the awards streams live on Curzon Home Cinema, and over this week's episode, we're going to go through each of the major awards, as well as hear from a few nominees. Roger Mainwood, whose film Ethel and Ernest was nominated for Best Animated Film, and William Oldroyd, the director of Lady Macbeth. But first of all, let's talk a bit about Berlin. Jake, how's your stay been so far?
It's been lovely.
Lovely.
Yep. I'm not suffering any form of Berlin syndrome. I would quite happily be locked in and kept here. It's a very nice place.
Be careful what you wish for.
I can see that you've put yourself between me and the door.
I have. What happened the last time you came to Berlin, Jake?
I had a great time at the Berlin Film Festival because on the plane over, I got some food poisoning. And so at the European debut of probably some of the most important films of 2015, I got to spend 4 days in bed and then leave. I came to the festival. I didn't see a single film. It was wonderful. But this time I feel rejuvenated. Berlin is back in my good books.
Excellent.
And the part of that has definitely been down to these awards.
Yeah, very fun awards this year. We've got a bit of a theme with last year as well, that we've spent most of our time at a Christmas market.
Yeah, yeah. I could get into this yearly routine of ours, that we go to somewhere in Europe. We get some mulled wine or some non-alcoholic apple and elderberry warm punch on one occasion. And maybe some curryverst. It's been lovely, and long may it continue.
Okay, so before we watched the awards, me and Jake wrote down our predictions of who we thought the winners would be for each category. You can definitely hear that there.
There's
hear that? That's actually been written down by us. We're going to hand them over now. We haven't seen what each other predicted. We obviously know the winners now, but
should
we hand those over?
Yep. So most right is buying tonight's Verst and Vine.
Let's start with category one then. This was Best Animated Feature, and the nominees were Ethel and Ernest, Louise by the Shore, Loving Vincent, and Zombillennium. But before we reveal the winner, let's hear from one of the nominees. So Ethel and Ernest is based on the graphic novel by Raymond Briggs, famous for writing The Snowman. And this is about his parents. Very straightforward, very simply told. We watched it the other night for the first time, didn't we?
Mm. After writing The Snowman, I thought it was a bit of a departure because that was quite a violent film. And
No. I think you're thinking of a different film called The Snowman.
Oh, right. Okay, this isn't Mr. Police.
This isn't Mr. Police.
No. Oh, that's a shame. That was my favourite writing of the year, those few sentences. This is actually a really lovely film. I think the first few minutes of it, you and I were a bit not sure of it as well.
Yeah.
'Cause it's like a children's TV programme from the 70s or something. That this is all very nice and calm and hand-drawn, and everyone's got rosy cheeks and laughs a lot and is jolly and not much drama happens. But we talk about this in the interview, kind of in the last 20 minutes, it sells itself.
Yeah.
And it rewards you for the first hour that you've put in of really getting to know this family and the journey that they've been on. And I went from being really unsure to really loving this film in the space of 80 minutes.
Yeah. So without further ado then, this was what happened when me and Jake met up with the director of Ethel and Ernest, Roger Mainwood.
We are delighted to welcome Roger Mainwood onto the Curzon Film Podcast to discuss Ethel and Ernest.
Indeed, Ethel and Ernest.
Yes. So this is obviously a very famous book directed and illustrated by Raymond Briggs. And so I want to ask you about the line we draw between replication and inspiration when you're looking at the style of the film. So when do you look at trying to imitate Raymond Briggs, and when do you put your stamp on it as well?
Right. Well, because he's a very famous illustrator and author, as you mentioned, famous for The Snowman, of course, everyone will know that, especially in the UK, where it's shown every Christmas. Because it's Raymond Briggs, everyone knows his style, so the idea was to reproduce it as closely as we could. Obviously, it's a different medium, cinema, to illustration, and there's lots of sort of inconsistencies in the illustration that Raymond's done, which are fine for a book, but when it comes to giving model sheets to animators, then they need something that's accurate and will follow through from scene to scene, so everyone's working to the same page. So we had to sort of bring his illustrations together into model sheets that were based on photos of his parents. The book is about his parents. We ought to say that from the start. And our animation director, Peter Dodd, did the model sheets for it and went down to visit Raymond and worked closely with him on them. So, and obviously, when we come to a cinema release, we have to think more filmic than illustration. The book is a chronology of their life together, 40 years of marriage from 1928 to 1971. And so I had to invent some scenes, especially at the beginning, to try and make it more cinematic and link some scenes that weren't linked in the book and take some scenes out that didn't seem to work with the narrative flow. And expand some scenes, especially during the wartime sequences. So yes, it's an adaptation of the book, but because it's such a personal book, we couldn't go off into some fantasy land as you might in some animations, and we couldn't break up the chronology of it. So it's a accurate portrayal of the book, but with a cinematic viewpoint.
And the film starts with Raymond himself.
It does.
Whose idea was that, to put him in to kind of give it a kind of a starting point?
That was mine. I thought it was important to have him there at the beginning so that people knew where it came from, because it's, you know, his story or his parents' story, and he's actually involved in the story itself, obviously. And it's a bit of a tradition with Raymond Briggs films. There's a live-action opening to The Snowman. In the original Snowman, he was there. And then in subsequent years, it was David Bowie who did an intro. And also When the Wind Blows is the other feature film that was done in the 80s, directed by Jimmy Murakami. That had a live-action opening as well of cruise missiles leaving Greenham Common and Molesworth. That I suggested, actually, that one as well, because I worked on that film and The Snowman. I thought it was important to have him there. There was quite a lot of discussion about whether we should have him there or whether we should just go straight into the story, but I think it was important. And then people around the world that are now seeing it, who might not even know who he is, will be able to, you know, check out who he is and have that connection. The film ends with some stills from his family album as well, and it sort of nicely bookends both ends of the film.
You mentioned about having to make slight changes to get the cinematic arc of a story that is not necessarily there in the book. And I think part of that challenge must be that it's, in terms of plot, despite being about 40 years and about a life, it's quite light on a traditional plot. It's more of a collection of scenes.
That's right.
So did you then have to find a structure that did link them. But you do also still leave it essentially as what it is, yes. Which is that lovely collection of
That's
snippets.
Right. Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, it was quite a hard one to sell. I don't think we'd have got it through the Hollywood system, for example. It sort of has a very European base to it, sensibility. And I've heard some critics describe it, you know, comparing it to Mike Leigh films or Ken Loach films even. There's also a bit of David Lean's Happy Breed in it, I feel, if you know that one. It's slices of life that sort of on their own, you know, may not add up to much, although they're very funny little moments and very poignant moments. But add them all together, and if you stick with the film, then people really become involved and really grow to love the characters. And, you know, the tears at the end of the film, which most people have, are well earned as a result.
Yeah, well, you have almost an hour, 70 minutes of almost watching without a dramatic involvement in it too much. And then the last 20 minutes, everyone who's been watching thinking they're just having a nice afternoon tea film suddenly found themselves falling into a tissue.
Yeah. Mind you, there is World War II in the middle of it.
That is...
Yes, it does creep up on you a bit, a bit like old age. It's a funny one. But as I say, I was a bit nervous, I must admit, during the making of it. I was kept on asking people, are we sure this is going to work? Where's the story, as you see in most films? But I just felt, you know, it worked as a book, and Raymond was executive producer on it, and I worked closely with him on the script and the storyboard. And I just knew if we were sort of faithful to the spirit of the book, then the film would work as well. It's not everyone's cup of tea, you know, it's not a Hollywood blockbuster, but it's got a lovely feel to it without being sentimental or nostalgic. I mean, there's nostalgia in there in that it's talking about times past, but it's not rose-tinted in any way.
And obviously the reason we're talking to you is because the film's nominated for a European Film Award. And you mentioned earlier that this wouldn't have been made in like a Hollywood system, but because of its kind of its European feel. Do you think that European feel has been felt by the Academy, and that's why it's nominated? It's sort of struck a chord with them in terms of its style?
I would hope so. I think it might have been. We've got wonderful voice artists in the leads, Jim Broadbent and Brenda Blethyn, of course, who are familiar to the European Film Awards. I mentioned Mike Leigh earlier. They're obviously stalwarts of course, his cast list. And in fact, it was Brenda's performance in Secret and Lies that clicked with me, and I thought, she'd be good for Ethel. And then Jim Broadbent's kind of just followed on from that. And they're friends in real life, and they've, you know, been on the stage together playing husband and wife. And we got them into the studio together so that they could bounce off each other with ad-libs and so forth. And normally when you do an animated film, you do separate voices and then edit them together. But it worked really well. And Raymond was in on those recording sessions. And, he said it was just like having his parents back in the room with him. So it was very touching. He had to keep going out the room to have a little moment to himself.
And before we let you go, Roger, it's creeping up to Christmas.
Yes.
And you've mentioned The Snowman already.
Indeed.
Can you talk a bit about, obviously you're an animator on The Snowman. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the endurability of The Snowman? You know, to this day, it's still on every year. Yeah. My family watch it every year.
Yes. Well, I suppose there is a connection with Ethel and Ernest with it, really, the poignancy of the ending.
Yeah.
And also, actually, the little boy and that the parents in Snowman are really Ethel and Ernest. Mm. And in fact, all his major work, there are references to his parents, not directly, but Jim and Hilda Bloggs in When the Wind Blows were really his parents. Yeah. And the house that they live in is very much similar to the house in Wimbledon Park where he grew up. So yes, there's all those connections, and the snowman has it running through it, really, that feeling that, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful relationship, but you know, it has to come to an end at some point. And I think that it's his honesty and truthfulness about life that appeals to people, and also his humour and his wonderful way of using irony in the words he uses in Ethel and Ernest as well. You know, it takes you off guard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Roger Mangold.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, very nice chap. Brought the book along with him as well.
Yep.
Just to prove it was definitely him.
Yeah.
He's definitely read the book.
Yep.
Okay then, so who did you predict for the winner?
As much as I loved Ethel and Ernest, just because I was thinking of the kind of European impact, I went for Loving Vincent.
As did I.
I can see that. So did we get it right?
We did get it right.
Yes.
Loving Vincent won. Like you say, we both really enjoyed Ethel and Ernest, but I think Loving Vincent's just had such a sort of surge of fandom behind it this year.
Well, even from years ago, we were seeing videos popping up on Facebook and Twitter saying, this is the first painted film, and you're seeing all these artists doing it, and you're seeing how much work is going in.
Yeah.
And I think part of Loving Vincent's success is as much down to it being a good film as it is the work that's gone into it, which is an angle for awards that every so often you'll find something that crops up, and it's like a Revenant-y thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where the work is as much as what the award is for as the film itself.
Definitely, yeah. So next up, we had the award for Best European Screenwriter, and the nominees were François Ozon for France, which we did an episode on, Oleg Nedin and Andrei Zyagnitsev for Loveless, Ildiko Enyedi for On Body and Soul, Yorgos Lanthimos and Efthymis Philippou for Killing of a Sacred Deer, and Ruben Östlund for The Square. Who did you predict?
For screenwriter, I went with Ruben Östlund.
As did I, and the winner was Ruben Östlund for The Square.
We just know it, mate. We're so good at this.
We're good. So far.
Yeah, I do want to point out, I think there's a really nice selection in there. I think France is actually a really nice pick, because the first half of this film is the whole plot of an Ernst Lubitsch film.
Right.
And then the second half is Ozon developing and seeing where that story can actually go further. So it's like a quasi-sequel, but also a retelling at the same time. So he's really challenged himself there and developing Paula Beer's character in the film. I would really seek that out. And she gets nominated for Best Actress as well.
She does, yeah. But yeah, so the winner was Ruben Östlund for his follow-up to Force Majeure, The Square. Next up then, the award for Best Director. The nominees were Andrei Zyagnitsev for Loveless, Ildiko Enyedi for On Body and Soul, Yorgos Lanthimos for Killing of a Sacred Deer, Aki Kaurismäki for The Other Side of Hope, and Ruben Östlund for The Square. Interesting overlap there with screenwriter. A lot of those were also the screenwriters. I predicted Ruben Östlund for The Square. You predicted
Ruben Östlund
for The Square. The winner was Ruben Östlund. There's already a pattern forming.
Yes.
It's very similar to last year, where slowly but surely the Tony Erdmann team was sweeping the board,
kept walking up
to the stage.
I think... I don't know if we read too much into it, but what you say about the screenplay and the directing thing, the idea of that kind of European auteur, like complete control, is very evident in these awards. There's no award for adapted screenplay.
Yeah.
That it is just screenplay. And so I think we're looking at films here that are very much someone's vision. I know people want to say that they're a collaborative effort, which definitely they are. But I think maybe the angle that these awards have is perhaps more focused on the individual artists at work.
And European cinema has always really been the artist, the one person's medium, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Ruben Östlund winning his second award tonight for Best Director for The Square. So let's talk a bit about the recipient of this year's winner for the award for European Achievement in World Cinema, which was Julie Delpy.
She actually made a really good speech about working in this industry in 30 years, that her award is not necessarily for an individual achievement. Her award was just for working and just managing.
She said, I'm here because I've survived in the industry for 30 years. That's the achievement. Because I think with Julie Delpy, it's not a specific film that defines her career, is there?
No.
It's just a big body of work.
Yeah, well, and in multiple roles as well.
Yeah.
And I think she was being as much rewarded as a filmmaker as she was being awarded for an actress. And she actually came on stage and explained the struggle she's been having trying to make a film. And part of that being that she would be the director and that financiers had dropped out because it was a female director. And she actually went on stage and said that she will be doing a raffle at the after party to try and raise some money that she needs to get this film made. And I think it was really highlighting the struggle.
Yeah.
Even someone with such a recognizable name and such a recognizable face in European cinema still struggles to get something made.
And she was true to her word, as at the after party, she did indeed pull a number out of a bag, and some lucky winner gets to have breakfast with her yesterday morning, which I'm sure did go ahead as planned.
Oh, yes. Yeah, she was very adamant that she would, as people bought tickets, she will talk about whatever they want for an hour. Presumably that was an hour of Avengers Age of Ultron chat.
Which is her most famous film.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
An unforgettable scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so next up then was the award for European Documentary. And the nominees were Austerlitz, Communion, La Chana, Stranger in Paradise, and The Good Postman. I predicted Stranger in Paradise for this, as it is a film revolving around refugees. And last year's winner, which was Fire at Sea, had a similar theme. And I thought that, once again, the European Film Academy would go for a film of that sort of heavy political weight to it.
Mm.
But they did not go for that. Did you get it right either, Jake?
No, I did not. No.
Which one did you go for?
I went for Austerlitz, but the winner in this case was Communion.
Yeah, which is a Polish documentary, which kind of, I believe, it blurs the line between fact and fiction. But a girl has to take care of her father, her autistic brother, and a mother who lives separately, and it's just sort of this small-scale family drama, I suppose.
Well, this actually kind of gives us not an issue, but something that crops up last year with the European Film Awards as well, is that a lot of these films have already had their wide release in Europe and haven't quite made it to England yet. And so there are a number of films that we'll be talking about in this show that we have been lucky enough to see, and some that we haven't, but none of which have actually made it into England yet, beyond festival screenings. The European documentary section being an example of that.
Yeah. So then next up, we saw Alexander Sukharov receive the award, the Lifetime Achievement Award.
So we got to have a chat with him about Russian Ark, about Francophonia, his most recent film. But predominantly the chat was very politically led.
Yes.
And he spoke about it in his speech on stage when he collected this award, about his issues with violence in films, which I think was really interesting, that he has taken a very, very strong anti-violence stance in cinema. And he told us that he actually went to the director of the Cannes Film Festival and proposed to them that they have no films that show any act of violence. And he explained that 95% of films have violence in some way, and that if we continually watch these acts of violence, we're going to regurgitate them. And what is particularly interesting is that he also talked about his next film, which will be set during World War II and is a science fiction fantasy film, which in itself is amazing that Alexander Sukharov is making that kind of film, which he did say is brand new to him, but to set something during that time, and seemingly it must not involve violence as well, which is it's going to be quite an achievement.
Absolutely. And I saw Russian Ark for the first time as well on Friday night.
Yeah, and to get to see it on the cinema screen for the first time.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, and as much as we love a Q&A, a 40-minute entirely Russian Q&A did sadly not inform our viewing as much as we hoped it would when we foolishly booked the tickets.
Congratulations, Alexander Sukharov, much deserved Lifetime Achievement Award. And then next up, Best Actress and Best Actor, with Peter Simonishek and Sandra Hüller, who won last year for their performances in Tony Erdmann. So nice to see those two again. Let's start with Best European Actor then. So the nominees were Nahuel Perez Biscaya from 120 BPM, Jean-Louis Trignon from Happy End. Joseph Hader from Stefan Zweig, Farewell to Europe. Colin Farrell from Killing of a Sacred Deer and Claes Bang from The Square. Should we break those down a little bit before we reveal the winner?
Yeah, I think it's obviously a very strong group there. Mm. And I think for me, this is the first category where I've really had to split my heart and my head for my predictions. Because as much as I really like Claes Bang in The Square, it's very much, he's a reserved character in it. He doesn't have a lot of visible emotion. It's very understated. It's very quiet. It's very subtle. And I really think it's a brilliant performance. But Nahuel Perez Biscayat in BPM, for me, is absolutely phenomenal. That film is such an emotional journey, and it's completely carried off his back. He is the person that is right inside the AIDS epidemic on a very physical level. And he is our entry point into ACT UP and the organization that the film follows. And he is absolutely astonishing in it. And so as much as I wanted him to win, we both felt before the awards began, this was going to be the night of The Square. So I put my BPM heart to one side, and my nomination was Claes Bang.
As was mine, and again, I think your decision paid off as Claes Bang took the stage to accept his award. Just to let you know, we haven't really discussed The Square that much yet in detail, because we're going to be talking about it a lot throughout the show.
Yeah.
As you can probably tell, it did quite well at the awards.
Mm.
Yeah, so Claes Bang there won Best Actor for The Square. Before we go into Best Actress, let's quickly go through the Excellence Awards. So these were all announced before the ceremony. So these are some of the more technical awards, so I'll just rattle some of these off for you. Best Cinematographer went to Mikael Krickman for Loveless. Production Designer went to Josephine Asberg for The Square. Costume Designer went to Katarzyna Lewinska for Spore. Hair and Makeup Artist went to Lindert van Nierenwegen for Brimstone.
Who was at the awards and did look amazing.
He looked like a 80s rock vampire.
Yeah.
Like something that Tom Cruise wore in Interview for the Vampire.
Yeah.
Composer went to Evgeny Galperin for Loveless. Sound Designer went to Oriol Tarrego for A Monster Calls. And Best Editor went to Robin Campillo for 120 BPM.
Yes, that's a really good shout. And if you do watch BPM, I think you'll see why it's got that editing award within the first 10 minutes.
He's the director as well, isn't
he? Right. Yeah, and in that first 10 minutes, you see a lecture of this AIDS activation group ACT UP and a meeting between all of their members. You see a flashback to a protest that kind of got botched, and then that flashback is then actually split up between how the different factions of the organization saw it. And so you...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
See the fractured nature of this organization. It's not just everyone is good, everyone's got the same vision.
Mm.
You see them together, you see them apart, and you see what they're driving for. And it's all told at the same time, all within those opening minutes. And that alone is fantastic. So, and that carries through the whole kind of 2.5 hours of that film.
Okay. Best European actress then. The nominees were Alexandra Borbelli for On Body and Soul, Florence Pugh for Lady Macbeth, Isabel Huppert for Happy End, Paula Beer for France, and Juliette Binoche for...
Let the Sun Shine In.
Okay. Who did you go for?
In this case, I went for Juliette Binoche for Let the Sunshine In. We talked about this on the London Film Festival podcast. Again, it's quite a reserved performance, but it's just, it's like on the tip of the precipice of almost breaking down. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that she's kind of just holding everything in for this character as she wheels through these male relationships, never really finding what she's looking for, but not really knowing what it is either. And you feel so much for her, even though you're never entirely sure what it is that she's feeling or you're feeling. It's this ambiguity of emotion that she translates so well. And yeah, that's why I went for Binoche.
I went for Florence Pugh for Lady Macbeth. I don't know if there was just a sort of surge of patriotism through me at that point.
But you got full Brexit at that point.
I got a bit Brexity at that point, perhaps, yeah. But I think we're going to be talking about Lady Macbeth a bit later on as well. But that's a film that has had a really admirable run.
Oh, yeah.
Through the past year.
And I would say it's still running.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just kind of, we saw it at LFF, not the most recent one, but the year before that. And since then, it's just slowly crept up on people.
Yeah.
And it has had this really successful run from nowhere, really.
Yeah, I think David Ehrlich for IndieWire has kind of championed it,
yeah,
or championed Florence Pugh, I should say, as a runner for Oscar,
right?
And I'd be really for that. I think it's a great performance, and it's really tight. It's cold, but it's full of anger as well.
Yeah,
and I'd forgotten just how funny she is. Like, she's got really good comic timing.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we're both wrong in this category, as the winner was Alexandra Borbelli for On Body and Soul.
Yeah, and I've not seen On Body and Soul. But I want to now, just to see her in it, because she was so nice as well.
She was so nice, and she had some sort of anxiety attack on stage, and she was so nervous and kept crying. And then even at the press conference later, and usually after these awards, by the time the winners get to the press conference, they've sort of calmed down.
Yeah.
They've maybe had their champagne already. They're a bit more relaxed, and she was still struggling to talk.
Yeah, and that actually, that made me really happy that she had won, because this was clearly a breakthrough for her. This is, like, you go on her Wikipedia, this is the role that's on there.
Yeah.
And you compare that to Isabelle Huppert or Juliette Binoche. I mean, those are your kind of easy options. Those are your European Film Award Meryl Streeps. Like, that's, you just chuck in there. As much as both of those performances are great, these awards can really do great service to elevating the awareness of lesser-known actors and filmmakers. And I think this category is a great shining example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the winner as well.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so then next up we have the award for Best Comedy. So the nominees were King of the Belgians, The Square, Vincent and the End of the World, and Welcome to Germany.
Yes.
Do we even need to say what we predicted and what won?
Well, I think from the tone of your voice, our listeners may have figured this one out already.
Yes, The Square won once again, and we knew it would.
But you pointed something out to me today, that this category in last year's awards, which we've already mentioned, was completely dominated by Tony Erdmann, the film that went around all of last year being infamously known as the three-hour German comedy, was not the film that won European comedy.
No, last year that went to Man Called Over.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what their rules are for the crossover.
Yeah, because this is an odd one, because it's not like you have an Oscar for comedy or a BAFTA for comedy.
You have a Golden Globe for comedy.
But that's because it's up for Best Picture, comedy or musical.
Yeah, with the Golden Globe, it's like you're either a drama or you're a comedy. Here, that clearly isn't the case.
Because you can be a comedy and you can be Best Film if you wanted to be.
I'm sure there's a reasoning that we don't know.
Yeah.
But The Square won that that award for Best Comedy. I mean, I'm sure there are some people that would not see The Square as a comedy as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
very funny.
It's very funny, but it's also a very subdued comedy.
Yeah, but maybe in the same way that Tony Erdmann is not necessarily an out-and-out comedy.
I think Tony Erdmann's quite broad, actually.
Yeah, I think Tony Urban's, I don't know, it's quite different.
Tony Urban's almost, not slapstick, but it does have...
It's farcy.
It's farce, yeah. I mean, the square is satire, but like deep satire.
Yeah.
But anyway, that so yeah, best comedy went to the square. Next up then, we have the European Discovery Award. Last year, this was won by The Happiest Day in the Life of Olli Mäki. Okay, the nominees this year for European Discovery were Bloody Milk, Godless, Lady Macbeth, Summer 1993, and The Eremites. But before we reveal the winner, here is our interview with the director of Lady Macbeth, William Oldroyd. So, William Oldroyd, welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so congratulations on your nominations for Lady Macbeth.
Great, yeah, thank you.
So we both saw the film over a year ago now at the UK premiere in a London Film Festival. So I imagine for
been
you that's
going
been...
going on for a long time.
Yeah.
We've really been milking it.
Yeah.
But what can you talk about how sort of your approach to the film has changed in that such a long time since it premiered? And, you know, if you're answering the same questions, like quite a lot, I imagine, but do your answers to those questions change?
I think that inevitably when, you know, you travel to different film festivals, and I've tried to go to most of them, mainly to support the independent distributors in each country. And also just because I'm very proud of the film and it's a first film and I want to sort of give it the best chance it can have at sort of getting a wide release. Meeting those audiences and hearing their thoughts has made me think differently about the film, because some people will bring things up I hadn't thought about.
Mm. And is that the same with like the critical response to the film? Like, are people or like theorising about the film or interpreting the film in new ways that make you think differently about it?
Yes, I have tried not to read too many of the critics. I think because they're, you know, on the whole being positive, but
yeah.
I realise, having worked for about 10 years in theatre, that if you believe those, then you also have to believe the ones that give you a kicking.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's tough. You know, if you start to... I mean, I'm really grateful that actually the reviews have been positive and helped the film to find an audience, but I don't want it to sort of interfere with the work that I do next.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, the stuff I have read has really, yeah, has helped me to sort of, it's shone a light on some of the things. I mean, I think you can make certain choices and you know why you're making it, but then actually what you can't really figure out is in individual interpretation, and think that for a certain audience members it's going to mean that when you hadn't actually worked that
out. Okay.
And that's been very interesting, you know, going through and hearing people's reaction to the film.
Yeah. And so you've kind of done the whole promotion of the film's release now, and I guess it's kind of starting the awards run at the moment. And does this kind of feel like the sort of the bookend of your relationship with the film in a way?
Well, I felt like actually when I was in Canada, I was in Toronto in maybe September, just before TIFF this year.
Okay.
It was the Canadian release of the film, having premiered the year before TIFF. And I felt like now is a good time, after a year of promoting this film, to maybe say this is the last.
Right, okay.
Because I had so many people who I work with who said, can you please stop travelling and come and actually do some work on another film, for example. Which has been quite... I've been able to do that on the road, you know, a lot of reading and a lot of... writing and so on with people, but yes, I guess it's never ending in a way. I'm really happy to do whatever I'm asked to do in order to support this film, because so many people put so much work into it, and so many people are very, so many collaborators of mine are very proud of this film. So if there's any way in which I can help to get a larger audience, I'll do that.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay, so in terms of the film itself then, you mentioned there that your background's in theatre.
Yeah.
And this is a, you know, relatively small scale film set largely in one location.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you worked with the cinematographer to kind of almost prevent it kind of looking like a filmed theatre production and really feel like a film?
Yes. Well, that was, I mean, Ari Wegner, she was our cinematographer, and that's the first thing we spoke about. Especially because we like to keep the camera quite still.
Yeah.
We like people to sort of be reasonably still within the frame. And there is a danger that it looks like it's sort of proscenium arch of the theatre.
Yeah.
And so what do we do? Well, we had to then develop a sort of language of you know, when would the camera move? Well, it has to move according to Florence, well, according to Catherine's motivation. So actually, by using Catherine as the motivation for the camera movement, then we connected the camera with her. So actually, we realised if you can, there's an emotional connection between audience and character, then maybe they're not thinking about the sort of mise-en-scene, which is the thing that can make it feel distancing. And we use that distancing effect when we need it, when Catherine is being objectified by the men, for example.
Okay.
So she's sort of placed small in the frame, and then they view her from afar, and she's then squashed by the frame, and she's contained and so on. But I was really, really careful, because the first few shorts I've made did feel like theatre on screen. And I think a lot of that is to do with language, like essentially the word being the sort of motor for the scene, whereas actually it's mainly about thought or maybe image in cinema. If we can capture thought rather than needing to say it, and actually... It's those sorts of things. But we were very, very mindful of it, absolutely. And I just really relied on our editor, Nick Emerson, and Ari, who shot it.
Yeah.
And also Alice as well, whose background is in theatre as well, to actually help me to try and take out what wasn't necessarily needed to be said.
Yeah. And, you know, when we think of, like, a period piece, you kind of, the first thing you think of is, like, a lavish country manor. But here it's, you know, it's all kind of... It's quite sparse and minimal, the setting. I mean, was that a conscious choice on your team's part, or was there a budgetary reason for that as well?
Well, both, always. But you know, we didn't have very much money, and we decided to make a virtue of the budget. When we first proposed that we make a period drama on that budget, people thought it was sort of certainly a bold move, because they're not typically made for the money we had. So we had to then think, well, what do we absolutely need? Every single decision we took was, we had to justify, because it was going to cost some money. And we were lucky, because Alice had written a script which actually had a sort of austerity of emotion, austerity of language. So the world was quite a sort of cold and empty place.
Yeah.
And then we found this brilliant old castle in Durham, on Chesterley Street near Durham. And it had been stripped because they had... shot a series in their TV series, the Paradise, I think it's called.
Okay.
And so they left it empty. So we went there, it was this sort of empty old house, and we thought, well, this actually is quite good for us. You can just imagine a woman standing there, and then you can put some furniture in there, and we can just sparsely furnish it. And it worked quite well because of the time of year we were in the northeast. The light that was coming through the windows reminded me of these Danish paintings I'd seen, Wilhelm Hammershøi's paintings, where again, very sparsely furnished rooms, women standing in isolation, usually wearing black, facing away from the viewer. Yeah. I thought, this feels right. This is a sort of right tone for the film. And we started empty, we just added what we needed.
Yeah.
And that was actually quite a good way of doing it. And then there were sort of very practical things that the designer did, for example, Jacqueline Abrahams, the designer. Like, she bought the furniture, for example, and then sold it back to a production house.
Okay.
So actually... You know, we weren't renting it for long periods of time and spending a lot of money.
And in terms of Florence then, before you cast her, had you seen her in The Falling, or did that come out later?
I went to see her in the cinema in The Falling, And Jaheen Begg, who cast Lady Macbeth, also cast The Falling. So she knew Florence, because she and Carol had worked to find her for that film.
Right.
I thought, I mean, you watch Florence in The Falling and you can just see it immediately. I mean, there she is. I mean, she's brilliant.
And was it quite a lot of workshopping with Florence as well to kind of shape Catherine?
We did a couple of auditions where we brought some guys in to sort of wrestle with her mainly. I mean, that was the sort of thing we needed to see, what sort of chemistry people had with each other. And then once we knew that Florence was going to play the part, then really it was just a case of sitting down for a few days with Florence and Naomi and Cosmo, who played Sebastian and Anna, and just making sure that we all knew what each thought was, more or less, because if we knew that was clear, then actually I would save time on our very tight shoot, because you know they would be able to sort of do that work without me needing to sort of step in and say, you know where we are now, and so on. And Then we had a bit of time to be able to play with some of the scenes a little bit, but they were very wary of actually sort of spending themselves emotionally. Yeah. Like they wanted to reserve it until we actually shot it, which I completely understand. And so we just went through some very basic blocking.
Okay.
But it was really to give them, to sort of empower them, to, you know, yeah, really to, and they've got such good instincts. Okay. Anyway.
And then finally then, something we were talking about was how Catherine does some quite sort of morally reprehensible things in the film, and yet there's still this air of sort of likability to her, in a way. Like, can you talk about how you worked that in? And
yes, I don't know whether kind of strange balance. I think, you know, we should be conflicted in the way in which we feel about Catherine at the end, because ultimately what she does to Anna is abhorrent, what she does to Teddy. And
yeah,
Sebastian, I think, deserves it. I think that's a betrayal, okay, which actually he asked for, you know. And also, she's not really attracted to a weak man like Sebastian, right, who's going to sort of confess in that way. But I think the setup is very important. If we understand why she'd want to do these things, why she needs to do these things, what her sort of the situation she finds herself in is so desperate, then I think we would understand at least.
Right. Okay.
And hopefully that understanding becomes empathetic if we play it right. I think Florence did so well to just judge it and play it right. It really has split the audience, where depending on where you go in the world, and we've been to some great places and found that people, friends who sit together and they go to the cinema all the time, one feels very strongly one way and the other feels very strongly the other way.
Okay.
And that, I think, is what makes good character.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you find that you're conflicted, and Alice was very keen to do that rather than to land heavily on one side or the other.
Yeah, sure. Okay, great. William Aldred, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Not only were we speaking to the nominated director, William Aldred, we were speaking to now a European Film Award winner, because he won the award for European Discovery for Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, so this is given out to first-time filmmakers, and you watch Lady Macbeth and you kind of forget that that's a first-time filmmaker, because it's so accomplished and it's so composed. And I think everyone in the room was pretty excited about what was going to come next, because the film was finished 18 months ago now. There's been a lot of time for William Aldred to, well, read and write and plan what's going to come next. And he gave some hints that he's got a project on the line. And I think a lot of people are really excited with what Florence Pugh's going to do. He did mention that in the time that they've been promoting the film, she's gone off and shot 5 films whilst he hasn't done anything.
Yeah.
But what I'm really excited about is The Little Drummer Girl, which is the follow-up from the Night Manager team. And it's going to be TV. She's the lead alongside Alexander Skarsgård. And Park Chan-wook is going to be directing. And I think after The Handmaiden, everyone will be really excited about that. And it's a kind of 70s thriller spies.
Oh, cool.
Really up for it.
Okay. And that segues nicely then to the award for Best Film. As you mentioned, Alexander Skarsgård there, whose father is Stellan Skarsgård, who presented the award for Best European Film.
He's not just that. He's your mate, isn't he?
He is also my mate, yeah. As you heard on our Borg McEnroe podcast, it ended with him saying, "Nice to see you again."
Yeah.
And he came up to me at the after party. He bought me a beer.
Yeah.
Very nice.
And he said, "Sam, I'm really, really thrilled you're here. I wasn't going to come until they told me
You are the best person that's ever interviewed me," he said.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
What can I say? None of that happened. The nominees for European Film were 120 BPM, Loveless, The Square, On Body and Soul, and The Other Side of Hope. And as you definitely know already, we both predicted The Square, and The Square won.
It did, yes.
The Square won 6 awards,
yep,
including the awards for actor. Absolute sweep.
Yep. Yeah, a very clean sweep, and it felt like everyone in the room already knew it, even down to the set dresses of the stage.
Yeah.
if you were watching the live stream of the show, you'll notice that they decided to form these little sketch recreations of Bergman and Pawlikowski films, and each one of them appeared in a square on stage that was lit with a white neon light, which is exactly the titular square from the film The Square. So I don't think anyone was really under any illusions that anything would be coming home with awards after the stage lit up like that.
Well, it's interesting, because last year I remember I predicted Best Film would go to I, Daniel Blake, because that won the Palme d'Or. And I thought, surely there must be some crossover between the Cannes committee and the European Film Committee.
Yeah.
That they'd pick the same stuff, but it didn't. So yeah, last year I went to Tony Erdmann, which didn't win best film at Cannes. And this year, again, I thought, oh, maybe it won't go to The Square, because The Square, if you don't know, won the Palme d'Or this year. So I toyed around with maybe on Body and Soul, or maybe Loveless. Loveless won best film at the London Film Festival and has a lot of love behind it, despite the title. Mm-hmm. Thanks. But I think you could just feel it, couldn't you, in the air?
Yeah, yeah. It was one of those nights. Once director and screenplay had already gone, I don't know where else it could go.
Yeah, I mean, if The Other Side of Hope suddenly won Best Picture, that would have been a huge surprise.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been against that. I really love that film.
I mean, these are good nominees.
Yeah.
But anything other than The Square winning would have been a surprise at that point.
Yeah, definitely.
So should we talk a bit about The Square then?
Yes.
Because it's not out in the UK until
next year.
So The Square is Ruben Östlund's follow-up to Force Majeure, and similarly to that film, it shows how one sort of somewhat meaningless act can have damaging repercussions to a man's sense of social placement.
Mm-hmm.
Where he fits into his own personal society.
Yeah, and the
people around him.
Yeah, I think what he considers to be his power,
yeah,
I think, is really fractured by it. I think he's very emasculated through the film.
Yeah, he is.
And he's really deconstructed on his belief.
My friend who recently saw The Square, she said that having been to Sweden, The Square nails that sort of sense of how, like, in Sweden there's this kind of sense of everyone is fighting for sort of social justice, but then there's also this rich, this affluence everywhere, and The Square nails that.
Yeah, well, that is the running contradiction throughout, that it is very much a middle-class audience who is at the centre of the plot, and at the gallery at which most of the events of the film unfold. And to be honest, most of the audience for this film as well is going to be seeing a reflection of themselves.
Totally.
I know from a lot of gallery visits and kind of artistic interpretations that I have made, I definitely, unfortunately, saw myself in a lot of this film. And I'm sure Ruben Östlund and Klaus Bang see themselves in this film. And that's what it does a really good job at doing.
Yeah.
And as well as being kind of quite damning, it's not shouting you in the face for wanting to go to museums and galleries and look at fine art. It's kind of just telling you to look at the paradoxes of it. Of how this square, which is the centerpiece of the exhibition, is a place where kind of all of your guilt can be unbound and you can be free and be safe, and ultimately that's pointless.
Yeah. And there's a sort of myth that at the Oscars, a film about Hollywood is more likely to win because Hollywood likes this sort of mirror being shown up to them.
Mm.
And this maybe that's the same reason The Square won so many awards, is that the Academy sort of saw a lot of themselves in it, in a way.
Yeah.
There was that reflective nature to it. Not that it's about filmmaking, but it's about that kind of world of, like, high culture and artistry.
Yeah, and it's got that self-awareness to it that awards season always really likes.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed that a film like The Square exists as well. The fact that it is 2.5 hours long, and a lot of the scenes do take a long time, and it's full of quiet, long takes. And the fact that it is that, and it is quite deep, but it is also really good fun. Like, there are scenes in it that are dragged out and out just because they're funny.
Yeah.
And he lets them breathe. There's a particular scene with a condom, Elizabeth Moss and Klaus Bang, which is excellent, and just gets really pulled out in both senses of the word, for about 10 minutes. It's excellent. And there is this this Monkey Man scene, which has been all over the marketing, and people will be talking about that a lot when the film comes out. They already have been since it debuted at Cannes. As a short film by itself, that scene would work, because this film is almost, in a way, a collection of random installations that Klaus Bang seems to be walking through.
Definitely. Okay, and like I said, it's not been released in the UK yet, so we'll We'll save some of our comment for it.
Well, we have actually got an interview with Ruben Östlund and Klaus Bang about the film for this very podcast, which we will be very excited to bring you.
Yes, we'll be going into more detail about the Square later on, but the Square was the big winner of the night. So well done to Ruben Östlund and his entire team. And that's it for us today. Thank you very much for listening.
Oh, mate, you've forgotten about our bet.
I have forgotten about our bet. I think it's a tie.
It is exactly a tie. We did exactly the same. I think we only varied on actress. Yeah.
Well, looks like we will be splitting the curry, wurst and mulled wine tonight then. And if you wanted to get your own taste of the European Film Awards, look no further than Curzon Home Cinema, where there are a few films that were nominated for awards tonight, as well as from last year's awards that you can actually watch right now on demand. For instance, Happy End, Michael Haneke's film, which led to Best Actor nominees for Jean-Louis Trignon and Best Actress nomination for Isabelle Huppert, is available on there, as well as Aki Kaurismäki's The Other Side of Hope. Francophonia, which was directed by Alexander Sukharov, who received the Lifetime Achievement Award. Lady Macbeth, the winner of the Discovery Award. And A Monster Calls, the winner of the award for sound design. You can also check out last year's films, My Life as a Courgette, A Man Called Irva, Land of Mine, and of course the big winner, Tony Erdmann, which are all on Curzon Home Cinema right now.
Right, well, thank you very much for listening. Yes, and hopefully we'll see you next year from Seville, where the 31st European Film Awards will be taking place. So it's goodbye from Jake.
Auf Wiedersehen.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.